Raymond is one of the pioneers of open source software development and the author of The Cathedral and the Bazaar. This is Eric Raymond. I'm Duncan Gammy. You're listening to Dunk Tank. All right. I am here with Eric Raymond. Eric, thank you very much for joining me today.
You're welcome.
So I had first heard of you because you had written a widely popular book within the engineering community called The Cathedral and the Bazaar. To start us off here, could you describe what the central metaphor that you reference in the title means? What is the difference between the cathedral and the bazaar?
I was pointing at a difference between two different and opposed styles of managing software development. On the one hand, the cathedral style, centralized, heavily controlled, top-down, and on the other hand, the bazaar style, a horizontal exchange of ideas between peers, much more loosely structured generally associated with open source development.
Right, and at the time that you were writing this, open source was much less accepted than it is now. But you were part of the group that helped open source gain widespread adoption. Open source used to be referred to as free software. Is that correct?
It still is by some people. The two terms have different connotations. People who use the term free software tend to be attached to the Free Software Foundation and have the approach of that closed source development is morally wrong and no one should ever do it. People who use the term open source tend to be more pragmatists who say you should do open source because it's better engineering and you get better results.
And the open source then was kind of a rebranding. From the perspective of the business community, why was referring to this kind of software as open source better than calling it free software?
Because it purged the idea of ideological connotations that business people weren't really happy with. And I comprehended that we needed to do this if we wanted to get support from people who could write actual checks.
It's interesting because in many ways what you're describing is basically like a marketing gimmick in many ways. There is more substance to it than that, but it is marketing. And a lot of engineers just hate engaging in that world. Why do you think that is?
Because, well, there are a number of reasons, but one of them is most of them are introverts. Introverts don't deal well with circumstances where they have to do marketing and sell ideas in front of the public. I happen to be one of the rarest of creatures, an extroverted hacker.
Do you think engineers sometimes sort of shoot themselves in the foot by not properly marketing their ideas?
That happens very often, actually.
Yeah, that's and one of the big things that happened as a result of your work and this rebranding was, I think you describe in the book, one of the main dominoes to fall was Netscape, which I believe was the biggest browser at the time, released their source code. Well, why was that so important?
From the point of view of people who were in business, it was the big persuader that this was a viable way to do software. If they knew of the open source culture as it then existed at all, they tended to think of it as a fringy, marginal thing that existed around university computer science departments.
I see. And so it sort of gained, let people in the business community say that this is acceptable.
But I want to correct you slightly. It wasn't a mere rebranding. It was also a way to encourage programmers to think differently about what they were doing. You think differently about how you're developing software if you have the whole cluster of ideas around open source, which includes the idea of transparency and decentralized peer review as key components of the process. The free software people never really had that. They had the moral idea that secrecy was a bad thing, but they didn't have an instrumental case. They didn't have a positive instrumental case that you could, for example, lower your error rates by encouraging a transparent process.
I see.
So not just a rebranding, a way to think differently about the process.
When you mentioned the lowering error rates, you had formulated something in the book called Linus's Law. Could you describe what that is?
Right. What I had observed, my initial revelation about this, was when I first encountered Linux in 1993. This was just after it had acquired TCP/IP capability. And a CD-ROM landed in my mailbox because I had contributed a fair amount of software to it even at that time. And the people who were putting together the Yggdrasil Linux distribution, which is now long gone, recognized this and thought, hey, we ought to send him a CD-ROM. And I plugged in the machine I was using at the time and instantly realized that I was looking at a world-class operating system, a Unix with an astonishing amount of reliability and polish, considering what I thought I knew about software engineering at the time. Because according to what we thought we knew about software engineering, it should never have worked. The attempts to do all of this development in a non-hierarchical fashion with lots of little project groups just tossing around more or less ad hoc patches should have failed horribly, because you're not supposed to be able to scale development up to groups that large and get results that are coherent. You're supposed to get killed by n-squared friction effects. But that had happened, and I set myself the task of understanding why that had not happened. And as I eliminated all of the obvious alternatives, it came up with various reasons that it couldn't be programming languages or the machines they were using or anything else. And eventually I zeroed in on, well, it has to be some aspect of the social machine around this software. And that's when it came home to me that what these people were doing were encouraging rapid release cycles and process transparency. And I thought about it for a while and realized maybe that's enough. In fact, it has to be enough. Otherwise, I couldn't see what I'm seeing.
Right, and just for people who may not know, when you referred earlier about the m-squared friction, is that to do with the idea from, I think it's called like the mythical man month, that
That's
the more
correct.
Developers
yeah.
you add, the longer the release will come out?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah, software engineering has had three major theorists of software complexity at scale. The first one, you might not have heard of, David Parnas. He taught us all about modularity and subroutines and separation of concerns. Then there was Brooks with the Mythical Man Month, who explored the problem of how rising friction costs in large groups of programmers eventually mean that you're getting less and less work done for each increment of manpower you throw at the problem. And this is the n-squared failure effect that I referred to earlier. So Brooks told us, keep your development groups small and tightly focused and constantly exercise rigid definition of objectives, because otherwise you will spiral out of control into chaos. And that's what I thought I knew, and Linux confronted me with a case where somehow Brooks's law was being broken, very seriously broken, and eventually you're reading the consequences and you're figuring out why that was.
Some people today have challenged Linus's law, particularly because of the Heartbleed bug that was found in OpenSSL, which lived there for a little more than 2 years. And do you have any opinions on that, or are there just bound to be some exceptions to the rule?
Sure. There's no silver bullet. If your software doesn't actually get looked at by a lot of people, it's not helpful to argue that it would have been better if it had been. And if the peer review actually has to happen, lots of people have to look at it. There is no guarantee that that will happen, but it will certainly never happen if you keep secrets. So,
right.
Open source is a necessary condition for decentralized peer review to root out all these bugs. But it's not a sufficient one. The peer review actually has to happen. And in the case of Heartbleed, it didn't. Life sucks sometimes.
Yeah. Why do you think that was? Because OpenSSL is a very big and important project that a lot of the internet depends on. I mean, you'd think there'd be plenty of contributors looking at it, right?
You know, to be honest, I'm a little surprised we haven't had a dozen Heartbleeds, and let me tell you why. We've got a lot of critical infrastructure, like the SSL libraries, all over the net doing critical functions, time service, DNS. All this work's being done by a relatively small cadre of volunteers, most of whom aren't getting paid for it. They do it for the love of the work. They do it because this is their dedication. And there are never enough of us. There are never enough of us. And the corporations that are making billions of dollars from this work are really, really reluctant to put out the small amounts of money that could keep developers working on these things. I'm surprised we haven't had a dozen Heartbleeds. It's a miracle we've only had one.
That's a really fascinating point, because I hadn't heard people say that before. That's one of the complaints about open source, is that these companies whose software is open source oftentimes live off of essentially free labor. Do you think there's any way that industry could subsidize
and
these things?
And not just the companies that are shipping open source. All the companies that are closed source out there are critically dependent on internet infrastructure that they're not helping cover the costs for. There are relatively small-scale efforts to address this, like the Linux Foundation, but for every company that is contributing to an outfit like the Linux Foundation or finding some individual developer they can sponsor, there are 2,000 companies that aren't. And as a result, the people who are doing critical maintenance on things like Heartbleed are underpaid, overstressed, and perpetually on the edge of burnout. It's remarkable that we do as well as we do.
I had talked to Andrew Bunny Wang recently. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he's a big advocate of open hardware. And he talked about the difference between the China way of developing technology, where schematics are widely available, and getting your hands on a factory is not that difficult. Whereas in the U.S., that's based very much on strict patent protection. We're talking about open source software right now, but do you have any thoughts on open hardware?
It's just as important, and it's much more difficult to do. It's just as important for all the reasons, the reliability, security, and assurance reasons that open source software is important, but it's harder to do because atoms are heavy, and making hardware involves a minimum level of capital cost much higher than making software. So, I mean, he's a brave man, and I give him all support, and I don't know how to solve his problem. I barely know how to solve mine.
Right. That's when we talk about patents on technology, there's a case to be made that if people had patented things like the compass or gunpowder when they were invented, civilization would just not be where it is today. Do you think the patent regime in the U.S. restricts the free flow of ideas?
Very much so. I am not as absolutely anti-patent as some people are. A lot of people think patents ought to be scrapped entirely. I think there might be a place for a patent system if patents were limited to a shorter term and the bar for obviousness were considerably raised. Considerably raised.
The bar for what now?
Obviousness at the state of the art. You can't patent anything that some random engineer at the state of the art could just write down. There has to be some genuine novelty or insight there. The quality of most software patents is very, very poor that way. There are cases of, like, Microsoft actually has a patent on the most obvious way of drawing a circle.
Do they really?
Yeah. That might have expired by now, but they had one at one time. And that was everybody's well, one of everybody's favorite cases for why the software patent system is ridiculous. And mostly it is. Mostly, the result of the software patent system is big companies acquire monster war chests of junk patents, 99% of which are silly, and which are only used as bargaining chips so they can do cross-licensing of patents with other big companies that have huge portfolios of junk patents. And the result is, who gets squeezed out? The small firm, the innovator, the individual developer.
You were around, speaking of Microsoft, what was the attitude of the hacker community towards Microsoft when they were on the rise and becoming a juggernaut?
Well, this is great hostility, actually. One of my functions was to say, don't worry about Microsoft, they're not our real problem. I contributed sometimes to anti-Microsoft stuff because they made a good target, especially when they said asinine things about open source and public, which they were prone to do back then. But mostly, my role was to say they're not our real problem. It's the proprietary method that they exemplify, the fetish of secrecy, that's our real problem. And don't fight tactics, fight strategy.
As a technologist, a hacker, do you, with the rise of social media and the standardization across the web, not just in terms of unique personal pages being replaced by like everyone's got their own Facebook page, but also in development, like a lot of the front ends are just basically bootstrap themes recycled. Do you are you at all worried about the loss of novelty on the internet?
Okay, let me acquaint you with a what Sturgeon's Law is?
No.
Somebody once complained, but so much of science fiction is just awful, shitty writing. And Theodore Sturgeon, the science fiction writer, countered 99% of everything is shit. So I don't think there's a lot of point in worrying about how much junky, bad software there is out there, because it's always going to be the case that 99% of everything is shit. The question is, do we retain the ability to produce high-quality software when we need to?
Right. And clearly that's the case today. And would you say that it's more the case today than it was when you first wrote this book?
Yes, I would, because I think open source methodology and the whole notion of process transparency, it's really worked. We've won a lot of important battles with that. I mean, the phone I'm talking with you over, the operating system, and it would never have happened without open source development. I mean, the whole smartphone revolution, in a lot of ways, is down to us.
Well, could you elaborate on that a little bit? Why'd you say the smartphone revolution in particular?
These are all the Android phones and the iPhone are all built around what were originally open source Unixes. They nowadays have some proprietary encrustations on them that are kind of unfortunate, but that technology would never have gotten off the ground without open source software.
Well, let's talk also about some of the limitations of open source. I believe in the book you mentioned something like a novel might never be open source. Was there a particular reason you chose that as an example, or are there any software projects that, not just for business reasons, but for practical purposes, should never be made open source?
No, you actually confused two different topics there.
Okay.
I don't think there is anything that cannot practically be open sourced. On the other hand, what I was talking about in the book was what sorts of things cannot practically be done in a decentralized way without basically a project dictator calling the shots. And that does have a well-defined answer in software. UI design. You can't do UI design in a bizarre style. It doesn't work. You have to pick a dictator who's whose taste you trust, and then hope he actually has good taste.
Why do you use, sorry, go ahead.
Because the thing about user experience is if it's not produced by a dictator, it won't have the kind of unity and unobtrusiveness that you really want. Lots of other things can be done by people tossing around patches and swarm attacking a problem, but designing a good usable UI, so far there's no evidence that it can be done that way.
I don't want to take up too much of your time here, so the last thing I wanted to ask you about is, I mean, do you think the major aims of the open source revolution have already been fulfilled, or is there still more work to be done here?
Those are two separate questions. The major aims that we could imagine back in around 1998 have largely been fulfilled. Open source has become a sufficiently large phenomenon that people who want to go proprietary actually have to justify it. They no longer take that for granted. On the other hand, there's a lot of work to be done because there are problems that we didn't anticipate in 1998. One of them is the social media monopoly, the increasing lock on public communications held by the Facebooks, the Twitters, the Googles. And this is becoming a real problem because these corporate monopolies are using their power to spy on people and meddle in politics. This is a problem we didn't anticipate in 1998. So there is work to be done, yes.
I want to follow up on that. Do you think that there's open source could be a way of dealing with these social network monopolies?
It's necessary for the software to counter these monopolies to be open source, but it's not sufficient. We also need other things as well. We need the financial mass and the popular buy-in to create alternatives that are not centrally controlled. And that's a really hard problem to solve because it's not primarily a software engineering problem.
Why do you say that?
It's not a software engineering problem to figure out how to persuade 20 or 50 million people to stop using centralized social medium A and switch to decentralized social medium B. You can't solve that with clever software. You have to do persuasion on a very large scale, and that's difficult and expensive.
Thank you to Eric Raymond, and thanks for listening to Dunk Tank. I'm Duncan Gammy. See you next time.